travel the United States and to go outside of city centers to speak to people in regions that, for example, voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. The reporting that Oliver does, I think, looks at a lot of important political and social intersections, including class, race, and other key issues that are defining politics today in the United States. I thought it would be meaningful at this time to speak with Oliver about his reporting. You know, recently he has worked on a number of pieces, including efforts to visit and to report on the detention and deportation machinery of ICE, the United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And I think overall it's really interesting and meaningful to speak with somebody who has been consistently out on the streets and in different communities in the United States at this time of immense change, and also the rising reality of populist authoritarianism under Donald Trump. So here is my conversation with Oliver. Oliver, you take the time to actually go into both like event spaces, but also just take the time to be out in different regions of the United States and engage directly with, you know, populations that, you know, for a lot of people have made shocking electoral choices. Not only that, are engaging with ideas that, you know, maybe a decade ago seemed very far outside of what was kind of the acceptable political parameters. In terms of mainstream discussion, these spaces have made a radical turn in terms of influencing the highest levels of government in the U.S. And I just have found your work very meaningful because you actually take the time to go and speak to folks in these spaces and also put yourself in a lot of, I mean, at least it seems to be stressful situations in terms of, you know, being on those sort of front lines of politics of the extreme right. Maybe if you could just first start by introducing yourself and maybe just responding to that first point about why being out in those spaces was something that interested you and why you felt it was politically important to hear those voices at that, at this particular moment in political history.
Sure. So I'm Oliver Lachlan. I am Southern Bureau Chief for The Guardian. I also present our politics series Anywhere But Washington, which I've been doing since 2020. And I guess the kind of entire ethos of the series is, as you say, to try and go to places outside of, you know, the kind of Washington bubble, hence the name Anywhere But Washington, and just spend time in communities. So, you know, the films that I've been making since 2020 have been shot all over the country, sometimes in swing states, sometimes in states where, you know, particularly in a presidential cycle, there's not a huge amount at play politically, but there's a lot at stake. And I think that is what we like trying to do, trying to find places that are often kind of ignored in mainstream political discourse and hear from people. Often that can mean kind of following a political candidate and looking at a down ballot race as a kind of microcosm for another issue or another theme in American life. But often it can mean just kind of spontaneously turning up and speaking to people. And I think often what I have found in the many years of doing this now is that that's when you get the most honest portrait of America. And yeah.
You're threading a needle here because I've noticed in a few of the different reports that you've worked on where when you mention the outlet that you work with, The Guardian, there's a political sort of response in the atmosphere. And so in a sense, people are performing a certain politics. I get that impression. But I also got the impression in some pieces that there is this sort of other aspect to, you know, let's say the less hype moments when you're going out into a particular community. And I know recently you've been spending time in Florida. What's your impression around trying to understand these political dynamics at play. Obviously, even within a particular state, the regional dynamics are different. But we are in this sort of strange moment where there is a huge disconnect between urban centers and the regions that you spend time in, and that is mirrored also in Canada.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we, as you mentioned, sometimes we do kind of go to more formal political spaces. So I have been to countless Trump rallies at this point. I think I tried to count it at the last election, but both sort of formal campaign events and informal county Republican events, have probably been to over 100 of those. And yeah, they can be pretty performative spaces where, you know, a lot of people are kind of clamoring to get on camera, to tell you their views, that sort of thing. And that, I think, serves a purpose in and of itself. It is important to try and understand, you know, where the Republican base is at this moment in politics. That last trip that you mentioned to Florida, we were just at the Turning Point Student Action Summit in Tampa, which is this kind of big Gen Z driven nonprofit for conservative and MAGA aligned people. And it was interesting there to sort of talk to people about what is, you know, very clearly becoming a split within the base, particularly among younger voters, around, you know, conspiracy theories on the Epstein file, and also, you know, genuinely pertinent questions about, you know, what the DOJ may or may not be holding back from this. And to see that on the ground is something that I think is demonstrable to me of a very, very real rift that you hear discussed on cable news sometimes and maybe don't see the reality of. But as you say, you know, to take that trip to Florida as an example, once we kind of exit those formal political spaces and just kind of drive and get out there and see people. So we didn't really have a huge amount of planning that went into this episode other than that one formal event. So we went and drove through the Everglades and just decided that we would turn up at Alligator Alcatraz, which is the new detention center that Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis have set up, you know, about 50, 60 miles outside of Miami, just to see what was going on there. And we ran into a spontaneous protest. We met some folks who had a family member detained inside. And instantly in that moment, I think you can really understand and see the stark contrast that exists in American life at the moment. So on the one hand, it's, you know, a formal Republican MAGA event where people are selling merch, you know, talking about some internal divisions within in the party, but broadly speaking, have done very well out of the Trump administration. On the other, literally, you know, 5 or 6 hours down the road, you see people who are losing out. And I think those sort of stark disparities and contrasts in American life and the realities of those are one of the things that we really try to kind of focus on in every episode that we make.
I mean, let's just touch a little bit more this reality you've described, apartheid style of status that's kind of being militarized right now in the United States. It's obviously something that is being talked about, but maybe you could just share a little bit more from your experience at this place that's been quote unquote dubbed Alcatraz Island.
Yeah, I mean, again, they're can be some degree of abstraction when you watch cable news in America. You know, I think everybody understands and knows that Donald Trump has, you know, followed through on a campaign pledge to enact mass deportations. But seeing the reality of that on the ground in a sort of spontaneous way really strikes home to me just how far reaching and deep this mission has been and how many lives have been impacted by it. So this family that we spoke to outside the detention center, it's completely unplanned. We just turned up and they were talking to us about how their loved one, it was a cousin who had been apprehended while mowing some lawns in Palm Beach, which is obviously, you know, a county in Florida where Trump owns Mar-a-Lago, which is actually where we ended up finishing the film. And, you know, in my other sort of day job, I split my time between doing these politics films, but I also work on the investigations team for The Guardian. I'm currently working on an immigration investigation, you know, looking at various aspects of detention centres in the South. And yeah, I feel it very presently. I live in New Orleans. New Orleans is kind of, or Louisiana anyway, is the sort of epicentre of the sort of detention centre industrial complex in America. And, you know, I know people personally who have had interactions with ICE and that sort of thing. So I think there is a sort of, you know, opportunity with these films in particular to kind of try and reflect and try and find the reality of what is going on the ground. And when you find those moments that don't require any sort of pre-planning, it's just literally turning up, they can, yeah, really help tell a story and, you know, hopefully do it in a way that is not always what you would see on kind of cable news in America.
There's a lot of companies, Geo Group is one that comes to mind, but I know there's a multitude of others that are involved in the process that you're addressing, that you visited. And maybe just on a sort of economic level, if you would like to share anything about that element of what's at play, because there is a lot of money, billions and billions involved in this reality. There's the politics of it, but there's also a lot of cash driven energy fueling the situation.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I just to sort of park the sort of money that's being made out of detention to talk broadly about like what is going on in the country at the moment. So the subject of this film that is going to come out in a couple of weeks' time, you know, was looking at the way in which Trump and the Trump family been profiteering from the presidency. So, you know, we were speaking to a lot of folks at this Turning Points convention about, you know, the acceptance of the Qatari jet, the $400 million jet that Trump seems to be accepting. And then we'll go to his presidential library after he ends his term. So, you know, it may well become his effective private jet for him, for his own personal use. And also his investment in cryptocurrency, particularly meme coin. So we were talking to a lot of people about that. We interviewed Steve Bannon about it, who's obviously been involved in meme coin himself, trying to sort of build a picture of how folks in the conservative world feel about Trump profiteering from his own presidency. And most people we spoke to, as you may well not be surprised to hear, were not particularly fazed by that, but would talk to us about what they think, you know, Trump and his presidency symbolized. And there was this moment where we were talking to somebody who was selling some of these like Trump gold trainers, who told me that he thought Trump symbolized American luxury. And again, when I was sort of thinking about that image and then spending time outside this detention center, the stark contrast between that reality and the reality for many Americans really was driven home to me. And I think that kind of growing disparity between wealthy elites and, you know, people on the ground living through, you know, major cutbacks to public services that Trump has just pushed through, hyper-realized immigration enforcement in low-income communities, is something that, you know, we're looking at in this film, but I think will continue to be, you know, the story of America over the next few years.
There can be this, I think, interesting political tendency to try to, like, carve out an understanding of how the dynamics of the sort of political world that you're describing has played out. And there's a critique of the sort of, let's say, Democratic Party center. It could be the Liberal Party in Canada or the Labour Party in the UK, and all the contradictions that are at play, particularly in the last decade, where there's a certain discourse that speaks to progressive values, but then economic policies that don't match that discourse, right? And so there can be this sort of process to try to understand why people have flocked to a certain extremist right politics. But what you're describing could maybe point us in a different direction, which is that there's this sort of open celebration of sort of a mafia style political reality, right? I'm not sure. I'm sure it depends on context and individual organization to sort of understand exactly what's at play, but I'd love to hear your thoughts about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you only have to look at Trump himself and the way in which he speaks about, you know, the jet, which I think has become this sort of symbol for many of the other sort of, you know, facets of self-enrichment that the new administration is engaged in. You know, it's open, it's brazen. He is talking about it in a way that doesn't really hide a huge amount. And yet, you know, the sort of acceptance of it is something that I was not shocked by at all, particularly in kind of Republican circles. You know, I have spent a lot of time over the past You know, well, I've been in America since 2014, but obviously been making this series for the past 5 years. Just being present in these circles, which, you know, to sort of many observers, and I guess to me, really kind of reflect a cult of personality where Trump, you know, he infamously said that he could get away with shooting somebody on Fifth Avenue and people would still vote for him. I think that is probably true. And this kind of brazen self-enrichment is just one example of that. Whether that create, you know, obviously we can kind of go back to the messaging of the Democratic Party in the 2024 election and question whether they really lent into some of the, you know, open goals that the Trump that the Trump campaign left them, you know, whether that was campaigning on or focusing more of a campaign on, you know, working class communities, talking about, you know, instigating a national minimum wage, for example, or raising the national minimum wage, you know, moving more towards smaller donations and not accepting money from large corporations, that sort of stuff. You know, I think the Democratic Party, and again, this is not something that I've really thought too much about since Trump was sworn in for the second term, because this has been such a sort of onslaught of, you know, extreme policy and extreme, you know, rhetoric, that thinking about the Democrats is not something we have done too much in this series. But yes, I think there is a chance for sort of realignment and a reprioritization. You've obviously seen what happened in New York with the election of, well, the primary victory of Zoran Mamdani. That to me is where, and again, sort of seeing this on the ground, when Democrats engage in, you know, populist politics, it cuts through in a different way.
Back to your experience, maybe we can just sort of focus on that for the rest of our conversation today, which is, I just would love to hear your perspective on some sort of key elements of what's going on in, you know, whether it's in communities that are voting in this direction, extreme right direction, or in these organized political spaces. What are some things that you think, you know, folks listening to the show are going to generally be progressive folks, although it's airing on a bunch of radio stations, so hello to whoever's hearing it. But what do you think are some things that are really important for people to hear that aren't cutting through in terms of a lot of reporting from your vantage point being on the ground?
I guess sort of speaking specifically about kind of the conservative communities that I have reported from, whether that be in, you know, rural Louisiana or, you know, suburban Pennsylvania, wherever it is. I'm always struck by people when you converse with them who seem to be kind of openly acknowledging that they are potentially voting against their own interests. So I have had numerous conversations with people, I'll take you through a few of them just because they, you know, spring to mind instantly. I remember being in Cameron, Louisiana, which is a town on the tip of the Gulf of Mexico that has been hit by numerous hurricanes, where residents have, you know, on many occasions lost everything, where there is a huge proliferation of liquid natural gas export terminals that most residents oppose, but has been backed entirely by the Trump administration. Trump, again, is somebody who denies climate science. These folks will tell you it's very real because they have lived through the extremes of it, but will still vote for him. And that has always struck me as just an extraordinary contrast, that you can live in such extreme circumstances, stand to lose out on so much because, you know, Trump is a climate change denier. He backs oil and gas proliferation in these communities. But there is something sort of deeply cultural that keeps people coming back and wanting to vote more. You know, I was in Pennsylvania, I remember, at a Trump rally talking about minimum wage increases. This was during the 2022 midterms when John Fetterman was running against Dr. Oz. Talking to folks in the crowd who were all planning, you know, who were all urging Trump to run again, who were all planning to vote for Dr. Oz. And when I spoke to them about Fetterman, you know, going on about raising the national minimum wage, would wholeheartedly agree with that as a policy position, but would just say they're not going to vote for him purely for kind of, you know, unspecified ideological reasons. And I think that is something that has always kind of struck me, this kind of extraordinary contradiction that exists in many of these communities, where folks who are well informed, who actually know about some of the details of these policy debates, will still vote against their own interests because there's a kind of higher ideological power that they are adhering to, I guess. And it's born out of culture, it's born out of history and affiliation with these parties, and it's also born out of, I think, a kind of failure of the Democratic Party in many enclaves of American society to deeply engage with communities too.
Last question. So on this point, I mean, you're spending time also in regions of the United States where there's this long coded history of racial segregation. This harkens back to the U.S. Civil War era. There's a lot of course, important history, racial dynamics that are at play also. And, you know, these dynamics are at play in different ways in other places. There's been a lot of analysis about this, but I would love to hear your thoughts on like how that actually plays out in terms of people you've spoken to, like how brazen is the discourse around this? What is the sense of understanding of how the culture that you're referencing actually is informed by these sort of more structural issues around race and nationalism, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like to sort of presume on when we're talking to sort of individual interviewees what their individual prejudices may or may not be. But certainly, to go back to that example I gave you in Louisiana, for example, there was an overwhelming sense of losing out and feeling like, the future that was on offer was, not available to folks living in these remote communities, and that, there is a sort of simplistic politics that I think can validate that sort of point of view. And often, it's extremely common, in fact, I would say, widespread, to hear, derogatory comments made about immigrants in particular. And then that is obviously, we made a film in Arizona in 2024 looking specifically about the immigration debate, and just kind of hearing these conspiracy theories regurgitated all over the country when it comes to, migrants coming into the country, voting for the Democratic Party, stealing jobs, all this sort of stuff. And that kind of, in my experience, very broadly speaking, has gone hand in hand with visiting these communities, hearing that sort of rhetoric, and hearing people's very direct grievances that are real, that relate to experiences of their everyday lives, of their communities, over time, but sort of responding to what I would say are often simplistic arguments, often arguments not rooted in reality, particularly when it comes to the debate on immigration.
Thanks for talking today, Oliver.
Thanks, Dave.
That was a conversation with Oliver Lachland, who is a reporter at The Guardian. He's been traveling the United States, interviewing folks in different communities, a critical media effort, I think, at this time of immense political change in the U.S. and internationally. Thank you so much to Oliver for being on the program. Free City Radio broadcasts weekly on campus community stations across Canada, including CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., CJLO 1690 a.m., also in Montreal, Wednesdays at 8 a.m., CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, British Columbia on Saturdays at 7 a.m., Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m., and CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby.